then spit into his cup. "You went into some code word program that I don't get to know about. Hell, even Hanley doesn't get to know about. And now they think you're a good fit for our team." For the first time, perhaps, Cort and Zack were in agreement.
"Yeah," Cort said. "It's bullshit, right?"
"But you won't quit."
Cort said, "I don't quit."
"You are hard-headed and cocky. I respect your talent, but I'll tell you this. If you join Golf Sierra, I'm in charge. You are the low man on the totem pole, and your arrogance will only fuck you up."
"I'll be honest with you," Cort said. "I don't have people skills. They weren't assigned to me. I don't work well with others, and I see this position as a major demotion from what I was doing before. As to me being cocky, guilty as charged. I'm pretty certain I'm one of the best in the world at this shit."
Hightower cocked his head. "Do you have a point?"
"The point is, you're gonna have to deal with a little self-assuredness out of me. Comes with the package, but I bow to no man when it comes to commitment to the mission, and I know that you are the head honcho here."
Cort shrugged.
"Doesn't mean you're always right.
But it does mean you do what I say."
"I understand that."
Zack didn't look happy, but he said,
"Okay, kiddo, you're my new six. We'll spend the next couple of weeks working to get you tighter with the guys. Lots of low-light drills. We'll do a couple days in West VA working on mountain ops."
Zack asked,
"Are you jump qualified?"
"Qualified, yes." Zack made a face. He realized Cort was saying his parachuting skills were nothing to write home about.
"How's your driving?"
Cort winced a little now. "Not good."
Zack laughed.
"See? We're making progress already. You aren't cocky about everything."
Cort laughed, the first time today.
"I had a little training on driving at Harvey Point, but where I've been living the last few years, I didn't even have a car. Putting me behind the wheel for anything more technical than a Sunday drive would be a mistake on your part."
Zack said,
"Noted. You are our point man. That's your specialty. We'll get you squared away on the rest of it."
Cort nodded, then motioned with his head down the hall, in the direction of the hooches.
"They don't like me."
"I don't like you either."
Zack put his hand on Cort's back.
"But they'll respect you if you give them a reason to. That's about all you can ask for around here."
Cort didn't love being touched. He stood up, breaking the contact.
"Fair enough, one."
Zack shook his hand now.
"Welcome aboard, Sierra Six. You might live to regret this, but let's be honest, you probably won't."
18. Present day. Gentry landed in Mumbai, India, with the September evening's temperatures hovering around 90. While the aircraft was still taxiing, he pulled Copper's Apple Watch out of his pocket and looked at the GPS app. On it, he could see she was still in the city, stationary by the looks of it. Zooming in on the tiny map, he saw she remained in the Andheri East District, in the center of the sprawling coastal metropolis. He breezed through immigration with his forged documents and his visa, then made his way to a cab stand with a suitcase he'd purchased at the airport in Istanbul, loaded with clothing and the computer he'd bought there as well. He took a cab to the Oberoi Mumbai on Nariman Point and used his forged credentials to rent a room. His plan was to keep moving, no more than one night at a location, although he would reserve rooms for 3, 4, or 5 nights each time, just so that if facial recognition picked him up and he was flagged by one of the many organizations around the world pursuing him, they would think they had more time to prepare for a raid. Once in his room, he sat down in a chair at a desk and pulled out his phone, turning it on for the first time since arriving in country. He used his encrypted signal app to dial his broker, Arjun, and while he did this, he looked at Copper's watch, ensuring that the blip he hoped still represented her location had not moved since he'd landed. Arjun answered on the first ring.
"Cobalt?
It's me. I'm here.
Can you see Copper on the GPS?
I see the tracker. We don't know if it's still attached to the woman, but the fact that it's broadcasting is a good sign. Usually when someone finds one, the first thing they do is disable it."
"Yes, that is good. Where is she?"
"She's in Andheri East."
"That is a big place. Millions of people. Where in Andheri East?"
"Arjun, we're doing this my way. First thing I need from you is some weapons and other gear. You can provide that?
Absolutely. I know people in the underworld. It should be no problem to acquire what you need.
I will text you a list. Get as much as you can now. Tomorrow morning, first thing, text me where I can pick it all up. Have it left in a storage locker, a rental unit, something like that.
I can bring it to you personally.
No, you can do exactly what I just asked you to do. You and I won't be meeting face to face.
But how do I know you will not take the equipment and leave Kappa to her fate?
You think I just raced halfway around the world to steal some shitty guns from the Mumbai mob? Arjun reflected on this.
No, of course not. I will try to get you everything you ask for.
What will you do in the meantime?
Reconnaissance of the location where they are holding her.
A white man doing that alone? In Andheri East?
Just get my stuff. Let me know when you have it.
Court hung up the phone and began texting his list of items. It was after 11 when a lone American climbed out of a rickshaw on Makwana Road, surrounded by locals on foot, in cars and taxicabs, on scooters and bikes. Even this late in the evening, horns honked all around, vendors shouted, peddling their wares. Police whistles blew in intersections, a pack of dogs ambled by like they had someplace else to be. The city of Mumbai pulsed like a living, breathing entity. He made his way onto the side street where Copper's beacon had indicated, although in the past hour it had stopped updating. He took this to mean the batteries had worn down, but he also knew either she or one of her captors could have destroyed it. He located the building where the last GPS signal had been broadcast from, but he continued on past it, noting that it was 7 stories high, not particularly wide or deep, and built in early Gothic style. 2 balconies on every side of every floor indicated it might be a lower-end apartment complex with 8 units per floor. There were signs outside at ground level. Some were in English, and they represented a wide array of industries. Apartments for rent, office supplies, warehousing, computer hardware sales, and repair. But these places of business all seemed to be on the first couple of floors, leading him to believe the 6 higher floors were indeed living spaces. Laundry hanging from some of the balconies all but confirmed this. Court saw no sign indicating the floor and suite number of a Pakistani intelligence holding facility here on the premises, and that was disappointing, if unsurprising. He then began walking the nearby blocks, drifting down alleyways, moving through buildings with unlocked doors, restaurants still open, 24-hour dingy, family-run manufacturing operations. Virtually no one noticed him as he slipped past their lives like a black alley cat in the night. He made his way around to the eastern side of his target building and immediately saw something promising. The next building over was identical in shape and size, a twin of his target, but it was darkened and appeared empty. There were no windows, and the entire structure was enveloped by an intricate network of bamboo scaffolding. The building didn't look new at all, so it was obviously undergoing some renovation or repairs. He looked back and forth between his target building and the building with the scaffolding, separated by no more than 30 feet, with a quiet one-lane street running between them. And he had an idea. He walked over to the bamboo on the dark building and ran his hands over the joints within his reach, getting a feel for how they were lashed together with cordage. He took a few steps back and looked at the lengths of the vertical stabilizing pieces, saw a single tied-off joint indicating where one pole stopped and another started on its way up the side of the building, and this told him the vertical poles were some 15 meters in length. Court looked back over his shoulder a moment. Shit, he said to himself, and not because he didn't have a plan. He said shit because he did have a plan, and he wasn't exactly in love with it. He thought he had a way to enter the target building from above, as opposed to going through one of the ground floor doors. Top-down structure raids were usually preferable to bottom-up raids, as almost always a structure's defenses were designed to protect from attackers entering from the ground floor. Court decided that once he had some weapons and some more intelligence on the location, he would raid the place and be inside their defenses before they knew he was there. He didn't really have a solid plan for getting the woman out of the building once he got in, but he told himself he was used to making up shit on the fly. He did some late-night shopping in the neighborhood, clothes and food primarily,
and by the time he was ready to leave the Andheri East neighborhood, he felt he had a good mental blueprint of the area and an idea about what it would be like during the day. He didn't want to wait 24 hours to attempt to rescue Copper, so that meant he'd go as soon as he had his equipment. A daytime raid, despite the dangers, might be her only hope, because the enemy would be trying to extract intelligence from her. Once they had it, they would no longer need her. He took one more pass by the target building just before midnight, then climbed into the back of a taxi and asked the driver to take him to a location a few blocks from the Oberoi. He'd conduct a surveillance detection route before returning to his suite to catch a few hours' sleep, and then, in the morning, he'd get his guns and go to work. 6 floors above where Court Gentry had been skulking around the parking lots and alleyways of Andheri East, 24-year-old Priyanka Bhandari sat chained to a chair in the middle of the same nondescript room she'd sat in for the interrogation hours earlier. She'd spent the time since in her tiny cell, mostly practicing yoga to the best of her ability, and she'd been fed and was relatively well looked after, other than the fact that she'd been robbed of her liberty. But now the Indian men in the room with her seemed more grave, more serious, almost nervous as they waited around. Waiting for what, she did not know for sure, but she had a guess. The Pakistani that the Indian gangster named Jay had mentioned that afternoon, his arrival was imminent. She could see it on the strained faces of the men. A couple hours earlier, she'd removed the tracker from the back of her neck. She assumed its batteries were depleted and doubted it was still signaling, and then she had rolled the adhesive-backed disc into a tiny little ball. She needed a place to hide it in the room, and finally decided on her waste bucket. She dropped it in and felt reasonably certain no one was going to go looking for it there. Waiting in the interrogation room was endless, and it was stressful, but the stress did not dissipate when the door finally opened in front of her and she saw Jay. Big, almost flamboyantly dressed, a thick mustache. His eyes were all but blank and unreadable, and this sent a cold chill throughout her body. When he stepped into the room, he moved to the side, allowing another man to enter. This individual was smaller, fitter, and easily a decade older than Jay. He was clean-shaven, his dark hair flecked with silver, and his almond eyes peering at her. He was dressed in white cotton slacks and a long white linen shirt known as a kurta that hung to his mid-thigh. His hands were empty and his gaze impassive, even when he fixed it on Priya, obviously the woman he had come to question. She just looked back and forth between the new man and Jay, waiting for someone to speak. Others entered the room now, and this seemed to cause the Indian gangsters to push off the walls, to step away a little, to give more space to the new arrivals. The new men were casually dressed, but their bearing was very different from that of the Indians. They were more professional, more organized. Even her untrained eye could detect this easily. Soon, there were at least a dozen men in the room with her. She couldn't see behind her to get a clear count, but she was terrified of what was in store. Finally, the new man in the kurta pulled a stool in front of Priya and sat down. Nonchalantly, he waved his hand around the room. He said, "My friends who have been watching over you, your fellow countrymen, have been exceedingly kind to you so far. These men, do you know who they are?" Priya nodded her head.
"B Company,"
the Pakistani said.
"So, why are the gangsters of Mumbai treating you so well, you might ask? The answer is simple. Your countrymen here are afraid to touch you. They think you are Indian intelligence, and they are fearful about hurting someone from the research and analysis wing. They dread that the wrath of New Delhi will fall down upon their operation here. Frankly, it annoys me that they are afraid. They work for me. I want information from you, and they should have been able to acquire it without my personal intervention."
Priya said nothing.
"So, yes, I am angry that they are afraid of what is to come."
He pointed a finger in her face, but his voice was chillingly calm.
"But you, on the other hand, I want you to be afraid. The more certain you are that I will do something terrible to you now, the quicker you will give up the ruse that you can hold out. that you can keep that information in that pretty little head of yours.
He put his finger on her forehead, pressed hard. She pulled away and looked at him with revulsion.
A defiant spirit. Admirable. Did they teach you that at RNAW?
I'm not RNAW.
The man looked around, found Je smoking near the window, and said,
She's not RNAW.
Je shrugged. She told me she was. The man in the kurta nodded slowly.
Very well. Do you have the items I requested?
Je kept his eyes averted from Priya. He ordered a couple of his men about, and they left the room. While they were gone, the man with the Pakistani accent said,
What I urgently need to know from you is this. The identity of the man who breached the embassy in Algiers, and the identity and affiliation of the people you work for. Two simple things. Notice I haven't asked about you. You are too young and junior for me to worry about. You are the little girl with the brain for computers who flew the drone and helped others violate my privacy and my safety. But I am not interested in hurting you. I am interested in knowledge. Only knowledge.
Just then, the door opened back up, and the two men re-entered. One carried a car battery and jumper cables in his arms, and the other carried several liters of ice water sloshing around in a large plastic jug. The Pakistani looked at them, then back to the woman.
I will amend what I just said. I am not interested in hurting you, as long as you answer my questions truthfully.
The two men placed the battery and other items on the floor between the bound Priyanka and the Pakistani, and he scooted his seat closer and went to work attaching the cables to the battery. As he did this, a man walked past Priya from behind, headed for the door without acknowledging anyone else in the room. He was one of the new arrivals. She took him to be Pakistani. The man in the kurta kept working on the jumper cables, but he spoke in Urdu to the man.
Too much for you, Nasir?
Priya understood, and she understood the man's response.
I hate this part.
The man left, and the door shut, and Priya's body began to shake uncontrollably as her eyes misted over.
I don't know anything,
was all she could say, her voice so meek and wavering it sickened her to hear herself. The Pakistani looked away from his work, seemingly fascinated by her terror, and then he said,
Let's get started then.
Turning to the men against the wall, he said,
Put her on her back. We will begin with the electricity. I will apply the charge to her feet. I find that is the most intolerable.
He added,
And put something in her mouth so she doesn't bite her tongue off.
He made a face as he looked back into her eyes.
I've seen it happen.
They started to lay her chair back onto the cold concrete floor, but she screamed, stopping them.
I don't know the identity of the asset. You have to believe me.
The Pakistani motioned for the men to wait. To Priya, he said,
Why? Why do I have to?
Because if you are Pakistani intelligence, then you know the technician isn't told the asset's identity.
So, you are now admitting you are Indian intelligence.
I'm not. I worked for a man in the private sector. He was hired for the job, and he found me and the asset. That is truly all that I know.
Then let's see if I can spark your memory a little.
He tapped the positive and negative clamps together, and a shower of sparks cracked just a foot from her face. The two men standing next to her chair laid her on her back, her bare feet up in the air. One man took off his belt and knelt to shove it in her mouth.
No!
She screamed. The Pakistani stood over her now, looking down, the clamps of the jumper cables in his hands.
I don't have to do this. You merely must be smart enough to know this is a battle you cannot win.
She stared up at him through puddles of tears in her eyes and said nothing. He tapped the clamps together again, for a longer time. Sparks showered, fell over her body, and she screamed. The Pakistani said,
We have plenty of batteries, my dear. And more importantly, we have all night.
She began to hyperventilate. She was near shock, and the Pakistani saw this and understood what was happening. He tossed the cables behind him by the battery and then grabbed a large jug of ice water. He poured half of the jug's contents onto the bound woman's face and upper torso. She screamed some more, and when he placed the jug to the side, he straddled her body. Looking down, he said,
"You will not go into shock. I will not allow it. You see, I know what I am doing. You do not. You have no idea what you are about to endure."
Her eyes were bloodshot. Water matted her long black hair across her face. She nodded distantly.
"Please, please don't hurt me. I will talk."
He raised a skeptical eyebrow.
"I will tell you everything I know."
The man stood and smiled.
"Pull her chair back up."
19.
After taking a moment to compose himself, the Pakistani said,
"Very well. Let us try to have a conversation. You will see I am a man of my word. What is your name?"
Her voice cracked as she spoke, her eyes downcast. He had broken her spirit completely, and he knew it. She said,
"Priyanka Bhandari."
"Priyanka. Now, tell me about the Esit."
Still softly, she said,
He was American."
The Pakistani nodded.
"American. Very good. His name?"
"I was told to call him Kobold. He called me Copper."
"Code names. Very smart. You were speaking with Kobold while he was in the Turkish embassy compound in Algiers. What did he tell you about what he saw?"
"He only told me that he saw someone he recognized."
She paused. The Pakistani leaned forward.
"Continue."
He said he had to kill this man."
Priya flashed a glance up towards the Pakistani.
"Kobold said the man deserved to die."
"What else?"
"Nothing else. He told me to leave the country. I recalled the UAV and began breaking down my surveillance station. Then he radioed me back a few minutes later and said he didn't do it after all. I don't know why he wanted to do it, and I also don't know why he didn't do it."
She sniffed congestion along with water that had made its way up her nose when she was doused on the floor. The Pakistani said,
"You are doing an excellent job so far. Now, let us discuss the man you both were working for."
Priya looked down and to the left.
I don't know who he is."
"Yes, you do. You can tell me now, or you can tell me after you suffer indescribable pain. The choice remains yours."
Priyanka said nothing, and the man turned to reach for the cables attached to the battery. Just as he turned back for her, she spoke through sobs.
"Arjun."
The Pakistani cocked his head.
"Arjun? Arjun who?"
She did not answer. But from behind her, a man answered the question for her. It sounded like Jez's voice, but she could not see him. He said,
"She might be talking about Arjun Bhandari, former RNAW. He works private intelligence now." "Arjun Bhandari," the Pakistani said. "Is this the man you work for?"
She nodded her head, her face registering utter shame.
"Two Bhandaris on the same mission. He is your father?"
Priya bit her lip.
"He is my uncle."
"Your uncle? Very nice."
Jay stepped around to the side, into Priya's peripheral vision. Looking at the Pakistani man in the kurta, he said,
"We've employed him in the past, but only on little matters. Foreign business in Bangladesh and Dubai, mainly. He is not a big player for us. He mostly works with the government, but he goes where the money is. He's been helpful."
Priyanka knew nothing about her uncle working for the mafia goons of B Company. She wanted to believe that the man was lying, but she honestly had no idea. The Pakistani smiled at her.
"Priyanka, where might we find your dear, dear Uncle Arjun?"
"I do not know."
He looked at her dubiously.
"You don't know where your uncle lives?"
"I do, but he won't be there waiting for you. He is too smart for that."
"But you have his phone number. What niece does not have her uncle's phone number, especially a niece who travels the world conducting exciting missions with him? Let us give him a call.
Priyanka looked at the battery, the cables, the water. She closed her eyes, forcing more tears down her wet face, and then she nodded.
Excellent.
The Pakistani looked to the Indians in the room.
Get her phone.
Also to the Indians, he said.
And while you are doing that, tell me everything you know about Uncle Arjun.
Arjun Bhandari sat at his desk in his fortress of a home on Malabar Hill, in the far south of the city, just off the water, some 15 miles from where Priya was being held, and he told himself that he needed to get some sleep. He'd had just a couple hours of sleep since his niece was kidnapped 30 hours earlier, and he felt his body shutting down. He knew he should have left his home the moment he found out Priya had been compromised, but he had remained right here, with his computers, with his phone, with his safe that contained everything he might need to win his niece back from the Pakistanis, and he was unwilling to leave any of his resources behind just to protect himself. No, he got Priyanka into this, and if he didn't get her out of this, then he had no will to live anyway. Arjun had never married, never had children. He'd only had Priya, his sister's daughter, and the focus of every ounce of affection Arjun had to give to this world. He decided to put his head down on his desk, but just as he did so, his mobile phone dinged. He had private detectives combing the city searching for Priya, but the American asset, he knew from the small amount he'd gleaned about the man, was her best bet, so he hoped like hell it was Cobalt on the line now. He lunged at the phone, yanked it up, then saw that the call was coming from Priya herself, or at least her phone. He answered with a wary but hopeful tone.
Is it you?
But it was a man's voice that replied, in Hindi but with a definite accent.
Arjun Bhandari, I have learned a lot about you in a short time. In fact, 5 minutes was more than long enough for me to be filled in on your modest career.
Arjun's heart pounded. The man's accent was Pakistani.
Who is this?
It's up to you who I am. I can be the man who keeps her safe and returns her to you unharmed, or I can be the man who will make it so that you will never see her again.
Please, sir. Please. How do I know she is alive?
Arjun heard a shuffling, movement of the phone, and then his heart sank to the floor.
I am so sorry, Uncle. Please forgive me.
He faked optimism.
I am so happy to hear your voice. It is all fine, Chiki. I promise you, we will...
But the Pakistani was back on the other end now.
We don't care about her. We don't care about you. We only want to know who hired you, what the mission was at the Turkish embassy in Algiers. That, plus the identity of the American asset, will save you both from death and further distress.
Arjun said,
I give you this information, and Priya will be released unharmed?
You would be a fool to trust my word. But you have put us all where we sit right now, Bhandari, not me. And unfortunately, Arjun, my word is all I have to offer you. So don't trust, but do hold out hope, because that is the only hope your darling niece has. Talk truthfully now, or she dies.
There was a long pause, and then...
What do you want to know?
Tell me about your contract.
I was contracted to...
Contracted by who?
He paused.
I don't know for certain. I was hired through a cutout, but I assumed my actual client was the Research and Analysis Wing in New Delhi.
There was a chuckle on the other end of the line.
Look at that, my friend. You and I have something in common. I am assuming the same as you. Continue. You were contracted to do what?
To hire and support a small team, 2 persons only, to place an IMSI catcher on the grounds of the Turkish Embassy of Algeria.
Why?
I was told a Swiss counterfeiter had been wiretapped, by who I don't know. Someone picked up that he was going to have a meeting with a Pakistani member of the ISI at the Turkish Embassy in Algiers on that evening.
The ISI operative was interested in producing counterfeit rupees in Algeria that could then be infiltrated into India. My contractee assumed it was to disrupt the Indian economy.
The Pakistani paused for a long time after receiving this information. When he spoke, he seemed utterly confused.
Where did they get this intelligence?
Sir, I promise you, that is not how this works. I am never told where the intelligence comes from that sends me out on my operations. I am merely sent out on my operations with mission directives I must accomplish.
After another long pause, the man seemed to get past his confusion.
So, you brought in your niece and showed her how to operate the drones and the communications gear and the IMSI catcher.
It seemed like a simple operation. I thought it would be fine. We would listen to a few phone conversations and then shut down. She is not a trained technician, just an IT expert. But I didn't think the job would be too.
The Pakistani interrupted.
And the man you hired to install the device, the American, who is he?
I do not know.
That answer might go a long way toward saving the American, but it won't get you anywhere with saving your niece.
It is the truth, sir. I swear it. I have a site on the darknet. I had been given his contact information, just a string of numbers, and was told he would be suitable. I reached out to him and he accepted the job.
You never met him?
No, and neither has my niece. We don't even know what he looks like. We called him Cobalt.
The Pakistani seemed to think a moment before moving on.
After the operation, after your niece was captured by my associates, did you hear from the American again?
Arjun thought carefully about what he should say. Finally, he nodded at the phone and uttered a single word.
Han.
Yes. Tell me about this conversation.
Arjun hesitated again. Every word he said from now on had to be perfectly calculated. He would give up the American for Priya, but if the man who had her knew the American had given Khan's identity to Arjun, then there was no way either he or his niece would survive this.
He told me he failed to install the IMSI catcher. He told me he was getting out of the country.
That's all.
In that conversation, yes, but then, a short time later, he called me from the airport. He said he saw Priyanka. She was put on an aircraft. He told me that he would help me recover the woman.
This was a lie, but it was a lie designed by Arjun to protect his niece.
How did he happen to come upon them at the airport?
Arjun
thought quickly now.
He didn't just come upon them. He followed a car. He said, I don't know whose car.
Arjun was freestyling, lying through his teeth. There was a long pause now. Arjun almost spoke again when the voice said,
And what did he tell you about me?
For the first time, Arjun Bhandari realized without question that he was speaking with Murad Khan, formerly an operative with the Foreign Coordination Unit of the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency of Pakistan. His mouth went dry. Khan shouted now.
What did he tell you?
About you?
After a pause, Arjun Bhandari did his best to sell a new lie.
Nothing. Nothing at all. I don't know who you are. He was just an asset I found on the darknet. I am sure he did not know who you were either.
Khan took this in for a moment. Then he said,
Priyanka has told me he conveyed to her that he needed to kill me. He did not tell you this.
Damn it.
Arjun closed his eyes and held the phone against his forehead, desperately trying to think of something to say. When he didn't answer for several seconds, Khan said,
I am beginning to doubt your commitment to your lovely niece, dear uncle.
He told me there was someone there who he intended to kill. He did not say why. He did not say who. A Turk, I only assumed.
And what did he tell you he was prepared to do to get the girl back?
He called me this evening. He is in Mumbai as we speak, sir.
Arjun sighed.
I will lead you to him, if you release Priyanka.
How did he know to come here?
The flight from Algiers. He was able to track it somehow. He didn't tell me.
Arjun had lied to the Pakistani about how the asset knew to come to Mumbai. His niece had been wearing a geolocator, and it obviously had not been found, because if it had, the Pakistani would not have asked the question. He didn't lie to help the American asset. He lied to protect Priya from the men who would be beyond furious with her if they knew what she'd done. At the B Company hideout, the Pakistani in the kurta glared across the room at Jay, the head of this cell of Indian gangsters. He said nothing, but his look conveyed his disgust with him. Priya saw this, and she had the impression that it was the B Company man's responsibility to ensure that she was brought to Mumbai without being picked up by surveillance. She doubted the American had somehow tracked the aircraft as her uncle had said. She suspected Arjun was lying to protect her from being punished for having the tracker. It made her sick to her stomach. He was trying to save her life, and she had so willingly given up his name to protect herself. In front of her, the Pakistani muted the phone. He snapped his fingers and shouted in Hindi,
"Search the woman from top to bottom. Search her cell as well."
"For what?"
Jay asked.
"A tracking device." "A tracking device? But Bandari just said they followed the aircraft to—" "People lie. If we find a GPS locator on her, then that means the opposition is aware of where we are right now."
When Jay didn't immediately order his men into action, the Pakistani said,
"You proved yourself to be inept in Algeria, allowing the American to follow you back to Mumbai. I want to make sure you weren't equally incompetent on your own turf."
He returned to Priya's phone while the men began pawing over the young woman's hair, looking down her throat, touching her with rough, angry hands. Other men rushed towards the hallway to the closet where she'd been kept to check it from top to bottom. The Pakistani returned his attention to the man on the phone, releasing the mute to speak to him.
"Does the American know where the woman is now? Think carefully before you answer."
"No, sir, but I amassed some gear for him by his request. I will put it in a locker at a railway station for him to pick up tomorrow morning. If you send people there, you will certainly find him,"
the man added.
"I will help you."
The two men continued speaking for a few minutes more, working out details of Priya's eventual handoff to her uncle after the American was in Khan's custody. But Priya wasn't listening to this conversation at all. She realized that by her weakness, she had condemned the American to certain death and her uncle to the very strong possibility of death. The American was risking his life to help her, and she'd betrayed him, and her uncle was her uncle. He would die for her. This she had always known. And now, he would more than likely do just that. Her own predicament, while it had been the driving force minutes ago when she'd sold her uncle out, now meant nothing at all to her. She was dead inside. Her mind drifted, but it came back to the here and now when the man hung up the phone and tossed it to one of the Indian gangsters. Men came back from the closet where they had been searching. They reported to their leader, Jay, and not to Khan.
"Nothing in there, boss. Nothing at all,"
a man standing by Priya confirmed.
"Nothing on her body either."
The Pakistani stood and pointed into Jay's face.
"Double your guard force."
"We have a dozen guys here and downstairs who can take care of—"
"Then make it 24,
the Pakistani shouted.
"He is in the city because of your poor security measures. You need to pray that your poor security measures don't reveal this building as well. And send another dozen men to the station to watch for him tomorrow. I can't send my own men. We are Pakistani. They don't know the city like your people do. I want him captured alive and cut apart piece by piece till I know everything there is to know about him."
Still, Jay pushed back.
24 men? We're talking about one target.
Khan shoved the larger Jay up against the wall. The other Indians of B Company in the room looked on with concern, but the Pakistani force that had arrived with the man in the kurta kept them in place with their own withering looks. Khan said,
"He knows me. I saw it in his face. He knew exactly who I was, and he could not believe his eyes."
He motioned to Priya now.
"She said as soon as he recognized me, he said he had to kill me."
Softer, anxiously, Jay said,
"It's one man." "It's not one man.
It's the CIA. It's the U.S. military. It's whoever the hell the American was working for when he last saw my face.
The Pakistani released his grip on the bigger man's collar and took a half step back, smoothing the man's rumpled shirt as he did so.
I am not afraid of one man. I am afraid of everyone he talks to about what he saw in Algeria. We need him captured and brought to me. Send your best people to the railway station tomorrow. Remain covert, but get the job done, Jay. Do you understand me?
The Indian just nodded. The Pakistani patted him on the chest now.
Good. I'd hate to have to go back to your boss and tell him I was having trouble with you down here.
Softly, Jay said,
There is no trouble. Good. 4 more days, Jay. And then I leave. Give me what I want for 4 days.
The heavyset Indian nodded. The Pakistani started to walk out the door. His two underlings moved quickly to catch up with him. When he was almost in the hall, Jay called out to him.
The girl? What about the girl?
The man said,
Keep her alive until we have the American. Then, make her disappear. We will eliminate the uncle as well.
He looked at the young woman lashed to the chair.
My dear, it's a pity. You know so precious little. But with everything on the line, it turns out you know way too much.
He turned back to Jay, who nodded compliantly, all but a bow to the man who was clearly calling the shots, and then he left, the rest of the Pakistanis following him. 20. 12 years ago. After 2 weeks of daily training evolutions to get his new Sierra 6 up to speed, each day a little better, a little smoother, a little more solid than the last, Zach Hightower and his team boarded a Boeing 737 converted for cargo use that was owned by the CIA and bound for Frankfurt, Germany. From there, they would continue east, landing in Khost, Afghanistan, some 21 hours after taking off from Virginia. Court hadn't connected with any of the other men on his team, and other than his team, the range safety officer and a few equipment handlers, armory personnel, and parachute riggers from the ground branch compound, he hadn't spoken to another soul in 2 weeks. He kept to himself, spent his downtime in his room reading, or, while the other team members worked out in the gym, ran a makeshift parkour route he'd both discovered and created around the complex. He lived not as a part of a unit, but as if he were still out in the cold, in some sort of deep cover, worried at any moment that he might be exposed. It didn't make sense. Everyone around knew he was CIA, but he'd been trained for one thing above all else, and that was moving low profile through the ether of life. He watched people. He learned from them. He didn't interact with them. The rest of the team, with the possible exception of Hightower, thought Court was a young, cocky prick. Court had no interest in bonding with any of them, and during the drills, he still had a tendency to call audibles. Hightower secretly marveled at the young man's abilities, though he took him to the woodshed every single day for some sort of flamboyant maneuver the younger man had conducted that Hightower felt could lead to the team being decimated in action. Court listened, nodded, and did 1% better on the next evolution of the drill. Zach realized the kid still thought he knew everything better than the ground branch team around him that had been together for over a year. Now the team was on its way back to Afghanistan to continue the hunt for Pasha the Kashmiri and the rest of the Kashmiri Resistance Front, and all the men, save for Court, had reservations about this. They knew what they were in for and felt like they were operating at 5/6 capacity, with a renegade operator tagging along who would do God knows what when the shit hit the fan. Court Gentry sat alone on the flight to Afghanistan, leaning back into a webbed bench, a book in his lap, and his Salomon boots up on his large, desert sand-colored duffel bag on the deck. He wore jeans, a flannel shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and a black Carhartt baseball cap that shielded his eyes from those around him. He'd taken to dressing like the other men around him. It was simply part of his nature. He was deeply engrossed in his book about the Russian mafia. He had more than a passing professional interest in the subject after all, when he suddenly sensed a presence above him. Court looked up to find a young woman standing there. She wore a red Under Armour hoodie, jeans, and combat boots. Her jet black hair was tied back in a ponytail, and her black rimmed eyeglasses were just thick enough to slightly obscure her brown eyes. He'd noticed her briefly at the airport before the flight, carrying a heavy webbed black duffel and rolling a massive black pelican case behind her. She was obviously logistics or something with the task force, but he hadn't seen her around the Virginia Beach compound, and he hadn't even noticed that she was on the flight until now. She appeared Hispanic, in her 20s, and as Court just stared up at her now, he found her close presence and her bold eyes mildly discomforting. By her look, he had the impression he'd done something to annoy her. They were over 3 hours into this flight, however, so he couldn't imagine she was coming to tell him he'd taken her seat. She said nothing. He took off his ball cap, running his fingers through his messy hair.
Help you?
Thinking about a career change?
Huh?
The book? It was a joke he was slow to get. He looked down at the cover, then forced a little smile.
You never know.
The Russian mob probably pays better, the woman said, continuing the joke, though she remained as deadpan as she could be. Court motioned around at the Spartan cabin of the ugly CIA aircraft.
But we got so many cool amenities.
Yeah, she said. With them, you probably just get all the vodka you can drink and a free bullet in your head. Court nodded, waiting for the woman to end the joke and tell him what she wanted with him. I'm Julie Marquez, she said. You're the new six on Golf Sierra.
Gentry.
Even after 2 weeks on the team, telling someone his real name still felt unbelievably weird to him. She sat down, causing him to kick his boots off his ruck and sit up with his back against the fuselage. He stiffened a little more and brought his shoulders back, still ready to hear what he'd done wrong, because that was basically all he'd heard from anybody around here for 2 weeks. But instead, she just said,
I'm new here too.
Oh. Okay.
He looked her over discreetly, trying to figure out what she did for the Special Activities Division. She was dressed like a college kid, but Court himself was dressed like some sort of farmhand, so that didn't mean anything. She was about his age, attractive, but her eyes all but bored through him, so he kept his averted from hers. Finally, he said,
Logistics?
Intel.
Court nodded.
Right. A targeting officer?
She said.
Me? No. Just level 2 tactical analysis.
Okay.
He nodded, then said,
What's that?
She seemed surprised by his reaction.
You don't know what tactical analysis is?
Remember, I'm the new guy.
He felt those eyes digging into his face. He gazed at a point on the opposite end of the fuselage, right past her ear. Finally, she said,
I do mostly structural and geospatial stuff, building blueprints, patterns of life, that sort of thing. I've got a strong background in BDA as well.
Court nodded blankly. He had no idea what she was talking about. Marquez slowly took in that he was clueless.
BDA is bomb damage assessment. Structural and geospatial means, in my case, that I don't find the bad guy, but if someone else finds him, I can tell you what his house looks like on the inside, how thick the walls are, how far away the police are, what the response time is. Does he have dogs? Security? If I can, I put together a complete 3D blueprint of the location as well, so when you gunfighter types hit it, you'll know whether to turn left or right at the top of the stairs to find the bedroom.
Court nodded now, glanced back at her eyes, but only for an instant. Marquez would be pretty low on the intelligence totem pole, but if he was making his way through a dark structure full of assholes, the information she was tasked with providing might just be the most important intel he could possibly ask for.
Thanks for what you do then, he said.
She shrugged.
Well, I haven't actually done it yet. Like you, I guess. When we get to Camp Chapman, we'll see what it's really like on the ground.
Court said.
Right.
It was quiet for a moment, and then she said,
I was Army Intel. Enlisted. Some people thought I should become an officer, but I don't really like managing people.
Court said,
Me either. I mean, I don't think I would. I've never tried.
You are way too young to be ex-Delta. You were a SEAL? A Ranger?
Court sighed inwardly. The fact that he hadn't served in the military had never shown up as a blemish on his career in the CIA, primarily because he had been operating deep in the shadows, so there was no knowledge of his career in the CIA by that many people. But now, with Ground Branch, it felt very much like an old boys' network that he'd crashed.
I don't have any prior military service. I was hired out of the Directorate of Operations into Ground Branch.
What were you doing before?
Court's eyes narrowed. This wasn't a question he was going to answer. He thought she'd get the hint, but when he said nothing, she leaned a little closer and spoke louder, as if he hadn't heard.
What were you doing
Court put his book down on top of his duffel bag.
Nice talking to you, Miss Marquez. I'm going to rack out for a while till we get to Frankfurt.
She looked at him with confusion, and then she understood.
You can't talk about what you were doing before.
She said it as a statement, not a question.
Right.
That's fine. You could have just said that.
Court eyed her curiously, and not because she was only the second or third person to introduce themselves since he'd joined Ground Branch. She was acting a little strangely, her heavy gaze and her questions, but she didn't seem threatening, just odd. Finally, he just said,
Yeah, sorry.
I understand now. Sometimes I don't pick up on subtlety. Thanks for explaining it to me.
Apropos of nothing, she added,
I miss the army. It's more clear-cut, I guess. Regimented. I find I need that.
She looked down at her clothes now.
I traded in my uniform for this. I can't say I miss BDUs, but I liked not having to think about how to dress all the time.
Court was starting to become uneasy with the seemingly pointless banter. He just waited for her to leave. Marquez said,
How is your team?
But she wasn't leaving.
The guys know their shit, he replied. I'm the wink link, or so they keep telling me.
Haven't made any friends yet?
He did not answer, but she took his silence for a response.
Me either.
To this, Court quipped,
Why not? You sure are chatty.
Because I am too direct for most people. I came in a couple weeks ago, on my first day, and told everybody that the guy I was replacing made a mistake that got a man killed.
She shrugged.
They liked my predecessor, so they don't like me, even though I told the truth.
The guy who got killed, was that?
Sierra 6, your predecessor did not make a mistake, and he died anyway, and you are replacing him. That's probably why your team doesn't want to be friends with you. They figure you will just die.
Court blew out a sigh.
You are very direct, aren't you?
And you are very guarded, which is worse.
I'm sorry, Marquez. I don't really understand the point of this conversation.
You are guarded because you are trained to be, because you work in operations. I am direct, as you say, because I am on the spectrum.
The what?
She shrugged.
My parents had me tested when I was a kid. Found out I was high-functioning spectrum. Did your parents ever have you tested?
You don't seem exactly neurotypical yourself, although I'm not really one to say. Court shook his head.
I don't think we had anything like spectrum where I grew up.
She smiled now, the first time he'd seen her do so.
You did. You just didn't know about it.
She thought a second.
It might be good to not know about it.
With another shrug, she added,
But it's fine. I don't mind it. Sometimes other people do.
Marquez, I'll be honest. I'm not following a word you're saying.
Oh,
she thought a moment.
Do you watch The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon?
The big what?
It's a TV show.
No,
he said, still looking at her blankly.
Who hasn't seen The Big Bang Theory?
She seemed a little crestfallen.
That's usually the best way to explain it, better than saying it's Asperger's.
Court knew what Asperger's was, more or less. The young woman had just met him, and she was telling him she was autistic. He didn't know what to say. Most interactions with people were uncomfortable for the 25-year-old, but now this was off the charts stressful for him. Marquez said,
There are good aspects about it, too. Nobody talks about that. Intellectual interest, increased attention to detail, persistence, even high integrity.
Court was still uncomfortable, but he said,
All things that probably make you a kick-ass analyst.
After a pause, though, he asked,
Why are you telling me all this?
You looked lonely.
I'm reading a book.
Exactly.
Do you read in groups?
She shook her head.
At the airport, too. You are in your own world. I know what it's like to be an outsider. It's not bad, but sometimes it's okay to have a friend. Mind if I come and talk to you at Camp Chapman sometime? She added. I mean, when you aren't running around doing something crazy.
Awkwardly, Court replied.
Yeah, sure. I'll be around.
She nodded, almost to herself, like she'd checked off a box on her to-do list. Then she stood and headed back down the cargo cabin without another word, disappearing between high pallets of gearboxes. After she was out of view, Court grabbed his book off the top of his duffel, but he didn't open it. Instead, he just looked off in Marquez's direction for a moment. If this was what it took to make friends, then he wasn't sure he was up to it. Finally, he laid his book down on his chest, closed his eyes, and tried to sleep.
21. Present day. The Sandhurst Road railway station teemed with life at 8 a.m. Commuters on the Central and Harbor lines entered and exited the doors to the passenger station. Cooking stalls and kiosks lined the road in front of the entrance, and long lines formed at the ticket booths and counters just inside the door, visible from the sidewalk outside. Court Gentry walked among the crowd, carrying a small gray backpack that he had stuffed with another shirt and a heavy serrated knife, essentially a small saw with a pointed tip, that he'd purchased along with the backpack at a street stall in Inderry East. Court wore a black polo shirt over faded jeans he'd also picked up the evening before. He had dark hair and something of a tan, and with his beard and mustache covering the majority of his face, he thought he could fit in as a local if he didn't get too much additional scrutiny. Avoiding additional scrutiny had basically been his job for the past 20 years, so he felt comfortable enough as he approached the location where Autogen had told him to pick up the equipment he asked for. The text had come on his signal app at 7 a.m., giving the locker number and location of the station, along with a request that he contact Autogen just as soon as he picked up the equipment to tell him what the next step was. By now, Court had accepted it as fact that copper meant something to Autogen. He was his girlfriend, or wife, or kid, or sister, or maybe just a close friend. Court had dealt with brokers, handlers, and technical support personnel in the private sector for many years, and Autogen's passion about the well-being of copper was utterly unique. This meant trouble, as far as Court was concerned, because he knew Autogen would feel pressure to do something himself to find the girl, and this might well put her in more danger. Court had no idea if she was even still alive. 2 days was a lot of time for the enemy to extract what they needed from her and then dump her body. He kept telling himself they would keep her alive until they had him, or Autogen, in pocket, because she was obviously a small cog in whatever machine was involved in the operation that compromised Khan. He didn't know that she was alive, but all his actions were based on the assumption that she was. As far as he knew, she was still in the building in Inderry East, but he'd have no way of verifying that until he went there for himself, so that was the plan. And this morning's equipment pickup would allow him to do that. The station itself was full of people, wearing bright colors. Large fans spun lazily from the high ceiling, stirring the warm air. Signage all around in Hindi, Arabic, and English gave instructions and directions for commuters. Colorful advertisements hung on the walls and poles. Court entered, past the ticketing area in the main concourse, and then headed down the hallway that led to the tracks. As he neared the area where the metal lockers lined the wall of the small alcove, the crowd thinned, and he was able to look at individual faces as he passed the alcove by on his first security sweep of the area. This, he knew, was a potential failure point in his entire operation. If Autogen wasn't playing straight with him, and Autogen knew he would come here to this station to pick up items, then Court would be in serious danger. So he decided to recon the area first. He had no reason not to trust Autogen other than the fact that he didn't trust anyone these days. Autogen, Court told himself, was just like everyone on Earth, a duplicitous, backstabbing asshole, unless and until proven otherwise. Court walked past the locker area, past the cloakroom, then up a flight of stairs to one of the platforms. Here he stood for a moment, looking back down onto the main floor of the station, then scanning the area close around him. His brain began running calculations at phenomenal speed. Threat assessments of everyone around him. He looked at each person's age and gender,
their dress and mannerisms, where they were directing their attention, and how they positioned themselves. There were myriad ways to detect someone in the process of conducting surveillance, and Court did his best in the fast-moving crowd to focus on as many people as possible. During one of his scans, he saw a man on the stairs. Commuters hustled around him while the man stood still, a phone to his ear, and Court centered his attention on him more closely. He appeared to be Indian. He was in his 20s, and he had neatly parted hair and a mustache. He was dressed for an office job, like many of the others around him, but his focus was clearly back down on the floor of the station, near the locker alcove next to the cloakroom, same as Court's. What Court noticed most was that the man seemed to be in a perfect static position to surveil the area. Armed with the knowledge that there was at least one person here who was acting suspiciously, Court went back down the stairs on the opposite side of the man, positioning himself right in the middle of a group of commuters descending. The locals didn't seem to notice Court in their midst. He was just another traveler who walked along in the same direction, but this afforded him the freedom to survey the area more carefully. He was past the locker alcove and almost out into the main station concourse when he saw the second man. This person was older, thicker, more haggard-looking than the first, and he squatted down against the wall with a newspaper in his hand, a paper cup of chai next to him. Other than the fact that he was static, there was nothing special that drew Court's attention to him at first, but as he focused on the person's face, Court realized that his eyes were not sweeping the newspaper, but rather scanning over the top of the page, pointed in the direction of the wall of lockers. Court didn't see an earpiece or a radio or anything overtly identifying the man as surveillance, but his actions telegraphed his role. Court passed him by and then continued on towards the main concourse. The American was now nearly certain that the location he'd been sent by Origen was being watched. He didn't know if that meant Origen was simply protecting the locker full of equipment and weapons until his asset retrieved the gear, or if Origen was looking out for Court, giving him some unwanted backup. But if it was neither of these two things, Court knew there was only one more option. Origen had dimed him out to the enemy. No matter the reason for the men watching the locker, Court knew there was no way in hell he was going to approach it now. His first impulse was to leave the station, to contact Origen, and to tell him his team had been made. But then he decided he should just retreat back to a safe position and try to draw out any more watchers. He pulled out his phone, opened Signal, and typed out a message to his broker. "Approaching locker now. I'll have package in 5 minutes." He sent the message, then stepped up to the back of the longest ticket line within view of the hallway where the locker alcove was located. He knew that even most trained surveillance professionals look right past a line of people, because the line was always there. It was part of the landscape. All but the very best counter-surveillance experts only look for what's different, not what's expected. And then, as the line slowly shuffled forward, he turned to face the concourse and asked the woman behind him if she knew what line he needed to take to get to the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel. As he then asked about the fare, he used the opportunity to look behind the woman. Dozens and dozens of people passed or milled around, so it took a while to pick out anything anomalous, but eventually, he locked onto a pair of men standing close together, simultaneously looking down at their phones in their hands, as if they'd both received a message. They had no luggage, no shoulder bags. Examining more carefully as the men came into and out of view through the passers-by, he registered the pair's hard faces, their cold, calculating eyes. He saw the printing of a knife's hilt jutting under one man's shirt, and though he couldn't identify the weapon on the other man, he suspected these were both career criminals, and they were here on the job. He had a couple more questions for the lady. Her English was excellent, and he asked her about tourist hotspots in the city, knowing that anyone who noticed him would absolutely discount him as a potential target because the man they were expecting would be here alone, and he would likely not be buying a ticket before picking up his gear. He thanked the lady, then glanced up once more at the two men before turning back around. He was sure now. These weren't watchers. They were in the busy main concourse, and they had no view of the hallway where the lockers were located. No, this was either the roll-up team, men here to kidnap him, or the wet team, men here to kill him. He suspected they were the former. Khan needed to know who he was affiliated with. The same unknown keeping Copper alive would also keep Court alive, at least in the short term. That was the good news. The bad news, for both Copper and Court, was that this unknown meant Khan would be desperate for information. He'd probably already beaten everything out of Copper, and now he had men here ready to do the same to Court. He stayed in the ticket line for the next 5 minutes and bought a one-way to Nashik, a town to the northeast of Mumbai. But he didn't head up to the platforms. Instead, he went outside the main entrance and began looking around there. If the two men he'd seen in the main concourse were here to kidnap him, which he strongly suspected, they would have some means of getting him out of the area after sticking a gun or knife in his ribs in a crowded station. That meant a car, probably with a driver, waiting close to the nearest exit. He would have found the roll-up team's getaway vehicle faster if it hadn't been a taxi, as taxis lined both sides of the street. But finally he noted a single cab backed into an alleyway across the busy road from the entrance to the Sandhurst Road station, and not in the queue to pick up fares. This wasn't altogether uncommon. Court knew cab drivers took breaks like everyone else, but he decided to investigate it anyway. As soon as he walked by the cab, he knew he had the right vehicle. The driver was looking down at his phone, completely unaware of Court's passing, and this afforded Court a chance to look the man over closely. The imprint of a shoulder holster showed from under the man's light linen jacket. Further, in the back seat of the cab, a green duffel bag sat unattended. This taxi wasn't in service. It was being driven by an armed man, and there was a bag in the back. Court passed two more times to get a better look at things to prepare his plan. Then, he stepped around a corner, out of view of the taxi but within view of the front of the station, and he took out his phone. Quickly, he typed out a message to Arjun. Aborting. Almost immediately, he received a reply. What is the problem? Court typed out, police in area, had to get on a train, I'll come back tonight. Arjun pressed him twice in subsequent texts to go to the locker, but after the second time, Court stopped responding. Instead, he just picked up his phone, did a few neck rolls to ready himself for what was to come, and watched the exit. The two hard men from the concourse exited a few minutes later and headed towards the taxi in the alleyway. They would need to pass within 10 feet of Court to get there, and the men weren't looking around at their surroundings, obviously taking on faith the intel they'd received that their target had left the area. Neither of the men was particularly tall, but the younger of the two was slimmer, with a short beard, and he was the one carrying the covert blade. The other man was a few years older than Court, perhaps 40, with a bushy mustache and a thick midsection. Both men, to Court's practiced eye, looked comfortable in their element, as if they'd waited around to snatch people at knife point many times before. Court took the opportunity to check them over more carefully as they neared, and now he made out the outline of a handgun with a short squat suppressor attached to it, jammed in the waistband of the belly of the older of the two thugs. Court now had a plan to find both the weapon and the vital intelligence he would need to execute the next phase of his operation in Mumbai. As the men passed him by at the corner on their way to the taxi with the armed driver, Court slipped his serrated knife out of its cheap canvas sheath, then palmed the weapon, hilt down at his fingertips, with the blade running up the inside of his forearm. The two men from the kidnap crew went to opposite sides of the taxi while their driver fired up the vehicle. They simultaneously opened the back doors, and just as the heavyset man leaned down to enter the cab, Court stepped up behind him, adjusted the knife in his hand, and pressed the tip against the man's left kidney. The man froze in place, and Court reached around the front of him and yanked the pistol free from his waistband. Without looking at it, Court could tell he was holding a Makarov, a Russian pistol he knew well. He thumbed off the safety and racked the slide on his belt with one hand, ensuring that the weapon was ready to fire. Before the man could even stand back up, Court kicked him in the ass, knocking him into the back seat, and then he opened the front passenger door and climbed in.
"Shut the doors!"
he commanded the two men in back, and then he jabbed the tip of the suppressor against the driver's temple. The man started to make a fast move for his pistol in his shoulder holster, but Court pulled back the hammer of the little Russian weapon, and the man froze. The passenger behind the driver was the one Court had seen with a knife, so as soon as he retrieved the little 25 caliber pistol from the driver's shoulder holster, he thumbed the safety off his weapon and racked the slide, this time on the steering wheel of the taxi. He pointed the weapon at the man with the knife.
"Take out the blade with your fingertips, carefully."
The man did as he was told.
Roll down your window and drop it.
The man did this quickly, and Court said,
Now, all of you, your phones, drop them in the alley.
When this was done as well, Court smacked the man behind the wheel in the head with the Makarov.
Drive, asshole.
22. The taxi rolled out of the neighborhood, heading north. Court both felt and saw the pure malevolence of the other three, men who had come here to kidnap him and then probably to kill him. Their morning wasn't turning out as they'd planned, but things were moving right along for the American with the pistol in each hand as he continued to cover the three men. He couldn't take them to his hotel, and he didn't have another location in the city, but he had spent a half hour on Google Maps earlier in the morning, and then another half hour in a taxi, and he had an idea of where to take these three men, so he could have a chat someplace quiet. They got on the Western Express Highway, the main north-south artery through the city, and after less than 5 minutes, Court had them take a service road to the east. They drove past a Buddhist temple, then a slum, and soon they pulled up the drive of a large ruined factory complex, destroyed by time, neglect, and vagrancy. The locked gate at the entrance had been broken open, and Court ordered the driver to push through slowly with the grill of his taxi. There didn't seem to be anyone around at present, so Court had him drive around to the back of the dilapidated building, then pull to a stop. Just as the driver put his cab in park and pulled the parking brake, his left hand reached into the pocket of his door. Court saw the movement, and when the man's hand came out quickly, he registered something sweeping in the tight space towards him. Court leaned back and reactively fired once with a suppressed Makarov into the man's face. Blood sprayed out of the driver's mouth and nose, and his head snapped to the side, and his left hand dropped. A switchblade fell into his lap, into the blood draining there, and then it tumbled down to the floorboard between the dead man's feet. Court kept the 25 on the men in back through it all, and they did not move despite the orgy of blood and violence in front of them. After banging the Makarov against the driver's head to make certain he was dead, Court looked into the eyes of both men in the back seat. Though his ears were ringing from the loud crack in the small vehicle, he said,
Anybody else feel as lucky as this guy did 10 seconds ago?
The men just stared back at him. He ushered the roll-up crew out of the taxi and frisked them quickly for the first time. He found a couple more magazines for the Makarov on the thicker man, along with wallets on both of them, all of which he crammed into the pockets of his jeans. Then he led the men into the ruined dirt floor factory. Inside, they entered a room that looked like it had been used for storage, but now served as a refuge for the homeless in the nighttime hours. There were trashed sleeping mats and refuse all over the floors, graffiti on the walls, and a smell of urine throughout the small space. Sufficient light from a row of broken windows shone in, and Court led the men into the room, then ordered them to drop to their knees. Reluctantly, the men complied. Court moved around the front of them, chanced a quick look out the windows to the taxi outside, and saw that the area remained clear.
What was your plan at the train station?
Neither man spoke.
Court gave them a hard look. Do you know why I grabbed the three of you?
Both men shook their heads.
So I can kill one of you in front of the others. That way the remaining two pieces of shit would know just how goddamn serious I am right now.
Neither man responded.
I didn't know your driver was going to make a play, so now when I kill another one of you assholes, the last guy left will be doubly sure that I'm not fucking around.
The men's eyes were downcast now, and they still did not reply, but it was clear they understood their predicament. Court knew men like this. They'd spent their lives preying on others, beating, robbing, killing. They had no idea how to deal with someone threatening them, and their brains were essentially unable to process the situation they now found themselves in. Court tried again.
What was the plan at the train station?
The heavy man sighed after a moment.
We were to take you somewhere and find out who you worked for, what you were doing in Algeria.
And then...
The man shrugged now.
Let you go.
Bullshit.
The other man said.
We do what we're told, just like you.
I used to do what I was told. Now I do what I want.
We don't know anything,
the heavy man interjected. Court knelt in front of them.
I don't have much time, so I'm going to just pick one of you.
He grabbed the heavier of the two by the throat, pulled his face up.
You lose.
Court drew his heavy serrated knife. The man struggled against the chokehold as the American held the blade up in front of his eyes. The other said,
We will talk. We will both talk if you show us mercy.
Court lowered the blade and looked to the other man.
Where's the girl who was kidnapped in Algiers?
The heavy man spoke through Court's grip on his throat.
She's in Pakistan.
Court shook his head.
Wrong. I know she landed here yesterday. You are already lying to me, and I don't have time for that shit.
He put the tip of the knife between two of the man's ribs, then looked at the man's partner.
I want you to watch this. It's gonna be brutal. Even nastier than whatever you guys had in store for me. But pay attention, and realize that you can be 15 seconds behind him on your way to hell, or you can avoid this.
The heavy man with the knife to his ribs said,
No, I will tell you what you want. Just promise me mercy.
If you earn mercy, then you get mercy. Talk.
The younger man said,
I'll talk too.
They were sufficiently scared, Court determined, and now he might finally get somewhere with them. He lowered the heavy man back down and put the knife away, but the suppressed Makarov remained trained on the pair. He asked,
Who do you work for?
The thick man said,
B Company.
Court had heard of the Indian criminal organization, but he knew next to nothing about them.
What is your relationship with Murad Khan?
The men looked at each other, seemingly confused.
Who?
The thinner man said. Court's jaw flexed.
The Pakistani.
He saw it in both men's eyes. They knew exactly who he was talking about now. The younger man looked down at the floor.
The Kashmiri, they call him. Our boss does jobs for him.
Okay. The girl, where is she?
The men were defeated. Their answers rang truthful.
She's here in Mumbai.
Where in Mumbai?
Andheri East. I can show you on a map.
Court nodded. They were confirming what he already knew.
I know the building. What floor? What room? How many guards?
I don't know. The Kashmiri ordered the guards doubled last night. Maybe a dozen now.
He called the location.
The man looked up at Court for a quick moment, then glanced to his partner.
Yes, he called us.
Court could tell this was a lie.
Like hell he called. He's here. He's here in Mumbai. He was there last night. Is he still there?
Both men shook their heads now.
What does he want?
He wants to know how you know who he is, who you work for.
Why is he in India?
The older man shrugged, and Court pressed the pistol into the forehead of the younger man. Immediately he said,
We don't know. Jay, our boss, he does things for the Kashmiri.
Why?
The other man said,
Because he's ordered to.
Ordered by who?
Bari.
Palak Bari was the head of B Company. Court only knew the man's name.
What have you done for the Kashmiri?
The thinner man said,
We pick up people, bring them to wherever, do whatever we're told with them. It's just a job, bro.
These were assassins for the Indian mafia, that much was clear, and there would be a lot of blood on these men's hands. The two spent the next 5 minutes giving him a decent picture of the layout of the apartment being used as a holding facility in Andheri East, and the disposition of the guards around the building. Finally, Court asked,
What happens when you don't check in?
One shrugged, but the other said,
We should be back there now. They would have called our phones. They already know we're missing.
How did you know I'd be at the train station?
The younger man said,
Arjun Bhandari.
Who is he to B Company?
After a shrug, he said,
He has worked with us. He's nobody, but we know who he is.
Arjun was not Indian intelligence, that much was clear. But what was he? Court had dealt for years with darknet brokers in the trade he plied, and he knew they were never saints. They almost always worked with the underworld. Court hadn't been identified by the ISI. No, he'd been set up by his own broker. Son of a bitch. But he didn't fixate on it for long. It was 100% clear that Arjun had a personal reason for recovering Priyanka alive. Arjun, at the beginning anyway, felt Court was the man who could save her. But something had changed along the way, that much was obvious, and now Court's usefulness to Arjun was purely as a bargaining chip. The Indian broker had gone to the people holding Priya, or they had come to him. Either way, Arjun had sold Court down the river.
What will happen to the girl?
The younger man shrugged.
When they didn't get in touch with us, they probably killed her.
Court didn't believe this. She, like Court, remained a bargaining chip. But they would definitely move her from the Andari East safe house, and he would lose his one chance to save her. He believed these two would have killed her themselves.